It is 3 o'clock, and I'm saying this because I'm supposed to say it. It's Friday afternoon, April 13th, 2018. We are assembled here in UMC 235 for panel 5305. We're very fortunate to have Robert George, John Harrison Nichols, Roger Walton, and Kamal Kahira with us, and they're here to discuss our subject, Meddling and Peddling, Russia's Tampering and Influence on Elections. They have each agreed to give us an opening comment of about 7 minutes, maybe a little bit less. Following the presentations, I will be directing your questions to the panelists. You can submit your questions using the conference app that you have downloaded onto your phone. If you have not done that, we have a great production team here of Richard, Linda, and Annie. If you would make yourselves visible for a moment. Well, there's Richard anyway. Great, there's Annie. So they have cards on which you can write questions. And you don't have to wait until the presentations are done. If you have an idea of a question, get their attention and get a card from them. But certainly, my laptop here will register the questions that you put onto your smartphones if you choose that vehicle to ask. My name is Joel Edelstein. My background is teaching political economy and international relations at CU Denver, then serving as the director of news and public affairs at KGNU. That's somewhat relevant to our subject for today. And I'm happy to introduce to you Robert George. He is a member of the Daily News editorial board. He's been writing about New York and national issues for nearly two decades after working on Capitol Hill in Washington.
Oh, you did want me to go first.
Yes.
Oh, well.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, I caught you off guard, Roger, because we had that conversation. I didn't put it into my notes. But actually, John Nichols is going to begin, and just a little.
It is Friday the 13th, folks. Sorry about that.
And you can find John's bio in the list of conference speakers, obviously. But one other thing you might know about him is that Nichols grew up in a town of about 970 people. He began his journalism career writing at the age of 10. John Harrison Nichols.
Thank you, brother. Thanks so much. And yes, I did start writing about politics at the age of 10. Town was so small, the newspaper so small, it's a weekly, that that I was sent out to cover the school board meeting the day I was hired. About a year after I got there, Hubert Humphrey, the former vice president, came to town on his last campaign for the presidency. And he spoke at a local hall, and he allowed us, after the speech, he would be willing to take some questions from the local media. And after he spoke, I got on his campaign bus, an 11-year-old with my notepad and my Polaroid camera, and asked him about a dozen questions, had him there for about a half hour. And it was an interesting thing because at the exact same moment, it was the highlight of my journalistic career and the low light of his political career. So I've been at this thing ever since. And I'm on this panel for a couple reasons, and I think it's not bad for people to explain why they're in front of you. I'm on this panel because I cover American politics, and suddenly a panel about Russia has an American political component that isn't the old Cold War thing, but might actually have elements of interconnection and meddling, peddling, and whatever we want to call it, that matters. So suddenly American political reporters have become experts in Russia, or maybe not. So take that always with a grain of salt as some of us come and pontificate about other countries and other leaders. Some people know a lot, some people know very little. And I think we've had a real problem with a lot of the media coverage of these issues. Secondly, I have covered elections in about 30 countries around the world, and on every continent, including being in Russia at times of elections. And so some experience on the complexities of these issues. Let me tell you first and foremost, because we have 7 minutes, not very long to sum things up. So I'll tell you one of the most important things to understand. The discussion about foreign meddling in American elections is the oldest political discussion in the United States of America. There's nothing older than this one. In the first real presidential election in American history, between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson in 1800, it was all about foreign meddling. And in fact, the argument was that Thomas Jefferson was an agent of the French and literally wanted to make the United States essentially a satellite of the French, and that John Adams was at best an agent of the British, but perhaps someone who wanted to create a model of the British monarchy in the United States of America. And so these discussions are not new, and in fact, where we're at right now, talking about Russian meddling in the U.S. election, it's at a much lower level than at some points in the past, not at a particularly higher level. But we are having a discussion that is very legitimate and very appropriate as regards American politics, because this notion of meddling in our elections, if indeed it occurs, is a hugely significant thing. And remember, meddling is separate from collaboration or collusion. A foreign government can have an influence on an election in a country without having a direct tie to the players therein. But if there is a connection between the foreign government and a player or players within that politics, you then move into one of the reasons why in 1787, the founders of the American experiment, after intense argument on the floor of the Constitutional Convention, included an impeachment provision. One of the primary reasons that they included it was because they thought very, very seriously about this danger. And in fact, if it could be proven that a individual had achieved the presidency or some other position in the higher levels of the United States, it was clearly thought that that was an impeachable offense if they were acting in the interest of that foreign government. And in fact, not merely an impeachable offense, essentially an impeachable requirement. It was a necessity that you got that person out of that position, because you couldn't possibly allow an agent of the British Crown to be manipulating what happened in the United States, this new foreign colony, or frankly the French. And it was for a reason that had less to do with the internal politics than the possibility that agents of empire would lead us into wars of conquest or wars of whim in which we should not have been a part, in which we didn't want to be a part of alliances that would lead us into places that we didn't want to be. So that brings us up to the moment we're at. And by the way, I'm going to ask members of the audience, if Rosenstein is fired during the course of our session here, I don't care how smart this guy is and what he's saying, you just interrupt, right? Because we are literally speaking in the moment of questions about all this and how the president will respond. And you know, the one thing I'll warn my liberal friends about is this. There is a possibility that Donald Trump isn't going to do any big, wild thing, because he really does feel at the end of the day the Mueller inquiry and all this will not prove anything about him. And that is, we keep that in the mix. But if, for instance, Rosenstein did get fired this afternoon, I would say your suspicions and your skepticism might be well reinforced. I think there are two things to look at as regards Donald Trump and the Russians, because obviously that's one of the reasons we are here. The first thing is, and we have to get to the bottom of both of these, I don't think we are at the bottom of either of them. First thing is Donald Trump's economic connections to Russian interests. This is not just to Vladimir Putin, it is also to Russian oligarchs. Those connections have been tweaked out and traced in some ways. The most interesting ways are through our Secretary of Commerce, Wilbur Ross, because we don't have a media in this country that covers politics seriously. We have not seriously examined Wilbur Ross to the extent that we should. But this is the guy who bailed Donald Trump out of his casino bankruptcies and then got involved in banking in Europe with players who clearly had been associated with Russian oligarchs. And so through our Secretary of Commerce, we see a series of connections that should be explored. It shouldn't be explored by Robert Mueller. It should be explored by the United States Congress. And if we had a Congress that actually understood the duties of checking and balancing the executive, that would happen, but we don't, so we have a special prosecutor. So much of this is there's a lot of stuff we're trying to figure out, but that we don't know. Second thing that we're exploring is the roots of, and the elements of Russian meddling in an election. These are separate things, right? Trump's connections, his interplay there, where that all goes. The second thing is, was there actual meddling? And if there was meddling, what was it? What was the reality of it? And I think we have dramatically under-examined this up to this point. My argument it will be, and we don't have enough time in this initial opening to play it out, my argument is that if you know anything about politics, and again, I'll emphasize our media in this country is barely competent to cover a presidential election, and in the deeper political issues, it does an incredibly lousy job. Within it, brilliant reporters, not to say that, but the overall media system is a mess. But if you understand anything about politics, what you want to look for is simple clues. And the simple clues would be, if you have foreign meddling in social media, is it targeted toward battleground states and toward communities within those states? And the interesting thing that we'll discuss as questions go on is, I come from Wisconsin, and there is an incredible pattern of troublesome meddling in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where we had a decreased African-American turnout after a series of social media postings that seemed to be aimed directly at the African-American community. If indeed that's true, and if you can find a person within the Trump organization that was tied to that, you have exactly the kind of stuff that we wrote a constitution and included an impeachment provision in because we were concerned about. If a foreign government was coming in to try to warp our elections, then that is an absolutely impeachable offense if the president and his associates were in any way associated with that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, John. Next, Robert H. George is a member of the Daily News editorial board. He's been writing about New York and national issues for nearly two decades after working on Capitol Hill in Washington.
I know I was supposed to give you an extra fun fact, but I've been on so many panels this week, I think all of these people have heard, and they don't need to hear anything more about me. I'm just curious, how many people in this room attended the previous panel on the Mueller investigation?
Say it good, there you go.
Oh, okay, thanks. I don't need to say another word. What I said then, that's it, no. I don't know if I've got a whole lot more new things to say about that, but I will observe that as the admitted Republican on the panel here, I have a confession to make. That everything that you've thought about collusion and conspiracy is absolutely true. This entire Russian plot is a conspiracy on the part of the Grand Ole Party to make Democrats recognize the collective wisdom of Ronald Reagan and Mitt Romney in recognizing that, yes, Russia is the evil empire. I imagine we'll end up talking a lot about the Mueller investigation and collusion and things like that. What I would like to talk about, though, is that Russia clearly meddled in the election in 2016, and they succeeded beyond their wildest dreams. I do not know if their goal was to actually elect Donald Trump, because seriously, I don't think even they believed that was going to happen. But what they and actually they're starting to realize now that he is so difficult to control that even after everything they did for him, you know, he's still going on. He's being pushed into adding sanctions and things like that. You know, so Donald Trump doesn't stick to any deal, even with the Russians. But the real success that the Russians had was undermining the American public's belief in their electoral systems. Yeah. And that is something that we are going to be having to deal with for many, many years to come. As my sparring partner in crime, Mr. Nichols, has pointed out, there's already legitimate debate going on for a few years about voting rights, voter fraud, these kind of issues. And there's fair battle between various sides about the inhibition on voting rights. And if there is voter fraud, and if not, but those are debates within the family, within Americans. But now we have clear evidence that a longtime hostile power decided to take advantage of those kind of battles and create deep doubt, really true doubt in whether our systems can be trusted. It's not just purely did Trump get elected or not. I mean, we have Mark Zuckerberg in front of the House and the Senate this week, one of the biggest one of the highest value companies in the world, asking about were they willful dupes for the Russians in this plot? Was it just because they felt that they had a right to Americans' data, and then ends up giving it over to maybe 87 million people's data over to what could be, what could possibly be a front company for the Russians. So this is having some real serious consequences. You've got now Democrats and Republicans looking at all of our tech companies and realizing how much of their data they have and how easily it is for that data to be corrupted and used and used against us. So that is real. I mean, I think that is really the issue now. Absolutely, what's going on with Mueller, FBI, and things like that. Yes, that's very, very important. We do need to find out what's going on there, but what really needs to be done in terms of the long term is to figure out how to prevent this from happening again, how to reinstate the confidence in our electoral systems. One of the things we may end up talking about later on, tangentially on this, is things like gerrymandering and stuff like that. But if Americans don't believe that there is integrity in the electoral system, they will be afraid to exercise their franchise. And if that is the case, then it will be said that truly, truly, Russia has won. Thank you.
Thank you, Robert. Kamal Kahira studies migration and refugees in Turkey. He has a long background at Bosphorus University in international relations. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. And he has literally lived and traveled through the Cold War. That is, in the 1960s, his family would regularly go back and forth in a Chevy Impala from Ankara to Geneva. Kamal Kahira.
Yeah. What were you doing with an Impala? Kemal Kilişci, you know, in 1966. Prior to it, my old...
Right there, brother.
Prior to it, my old man had a Opel Capitan, 1960. It would always break down, and breaking down in a Stalinist Russia was indeed a challenge. But I do also have, like Robert, a confession to make. I don't know why I'm here at this panel. I listened to John with really great fascination, and also to Robert. But I thought I caught a common denominator on which I could build a couple of remarks, half-informed remarks, bearing in mind what John said about experts and non-experts on Russia, just that geographic I've been in geographic proximity of Russia and got a taste of the Cold War, I feel doesn't necessarily make me an expert. However, so far I think we have talked about interference in the actual process of elections. I'd like to say a word about that and how Russia's expertise on doing that is improving and may really get difficult to deal with and raise a question on what might we be able to do. And the second aspect of the second point I'd like to make is that before each election, democracies have to have a debate. And information is critical to the debate, and Russia is meddling in that as well. Let me give you how their technique is improving. In 2004, I believe in November in Ukraine, there was an election between two candidates, which is very confusing, who both had the name Viktor or Viktor. One was the serving prime minister to be elected as president and very pro-Russian, and the other one was a pro-Western candidate. Prior to the election, you may have already seen this on TV, the pro-Western candidate was poisoned and his face has been disfigured since. So that's one technique. And to make sure that their candidate would win, they also send thugs to where ballot boxes are and openly stuff the ballot boxes with ballots themselves. And in areas where they were sure there would be pro-Russian voting, they also added 1 million plus votes that actually didn't exist. They reincarnated voters there. And went ahead and in the Russian media declared a victory in favor of their own Viktor. However, the reality turned out to be a very different one, and the pro-Western candidate won it. Exactly 10 years later, in 2014, on the heels of the Maidan protest that had occurred, there was another election to take place. The difference this time, the techniques were very different. It had more to do with digital manipulation and then the injection. This is where I get lost because I'm stuck with the 1966 Impala technology. but a virus was injected into the Ukrainian election system, software. And the outcome was going to be prejudged. An announcement would be made accordingly. But the Ukrainian experts, cyber experts, were able to detect and prevent this from taking place. But the chaos culminated in the election having to be rerun. What we are fearing, or those who are familiar with the challenges, and there is a very recent Brookings report that has come out on this topic by an American young lady of Ukrainian descent, Alina Polikova, precisely warning the U.S. and Western countries that Russia is beginning to work on artificial intelligence, which will become more difficult to detect and to combat. In the couple of minutes I'm left with, I'd like to go to the other side of the medallion and the debate part of it, the information part of it, and share with you a couple of examples from Europe to show how Russia is trying to influence that debate exercise, possibly here as well, and in Europe. One is from January 2016, when suddenly in the news in Europe and here as well appeared the news that an immigrant had assaulted a 13-year-old German girl. And like bushfire, it spread in all directions until the police chief involved in the disappearing of the girl, who had disappeared for 30 hours or so, made a public declaration that nothing of the kind had happened. But you must remember that this is happening on the heels of Angela Merkel's decision to open the doors for Syrian refugees fleeing this destruction there. Macron had, the French president, was elected very recently. Prior to the elections, again, there was a leak of his email messages at the 11th hour, mm-hmm. impacting again, trying to impact the electorate's calculation, political calculation before casting their vote. Last example I'd like to give comes from the way in which Russia cooperates very closely with right-wing political parties in especially Western Europe, like Front National in France, but the Alternative for Deutschland, and the way in which it financially provides support, but also establishes linkages between these groups and their counterparts in Russia. What to do? 1 minute.
Perfect.
And I will leave you with a question, and maybe also a very innocent one. In the days when my old man would be driving us through those countries, there was something called MAD, mutually assured destruction, deterrence, to dissuading your adversary from inflicting harm on you by making the adversary recognize that you can hurt him or her as well. It would something along the lines be possible to develop against this cyber weaponry and artificial intelligence that seems to be around the corner, is the question that I'd like to leave with you, and also confess that I have depleted my ammunition as far as this topic goes here.
Well, you did it well. Thank you. Just rearm for the next.
Thank you, Kamal. Roger Walton is now General Manager of North and South America for, and I'm not sure I'm pronouncing this correctly, Quanteca?
Sounds good enough. Quantexa.
Quantexa, a UK data analytics company. After spending 25 years in general management, sales, alliances, and business development in Europe and North America. And Roger confessed to me that after years as a closet vegetarian, he is now out. Roger Walton.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Well, when I was asked to kind of present or be part of this panel, I kind of got a little bit nervous. I'd like to, I suppose I'm a data guy. So I suppose my angle on this is going to be a little bit about how this has happened, but I'll talk about that in a minute, and perhaps some of the things that we might be able to do to control it and prevent it. But one of the things that's interesting, and John, maybe we'll chat later, that my organization, we look for patterns in financial data, and we found some very interesting data around the Russian laundromat scandal, which I'm sure you're fully aware of. So I'll show you some pictures later on that I think might be quite enticing and interesting for you. So I completely
appreciate it, my
friend, with what you were saying, and it is very, very scary. But anyway, one of the things, I suppose I'm a little bit of a frustrated political observer. I've varied my opinions on politics over the years, and recently I was very lucky to be invited to the UK Houses of Parliament and to meet an MP called Dennis Skinner. I don't know if any of you have seen any of the politics that goes on in the UK, and you've seen when there's the two sides of the House and they go and ding-dong at each other and they start shouting and waving their papers and all this kind of stuff. I don't know if you've seen that, but if you've ever heard or seen Dennis Skinner, he's a real character. He's 84 years old. He's the longest serving UK MP. He is completely out there on the left, to the point of almost revolutionary, if you like. He's an anti-monarchist. So
as are we.
Me too. But I was very lucky to meet him. In fact, my partner here, she actually made the introduction for me. And I went to the Houses of Parliament, and it was a very beautiful, regal environment and full of fantastic history and pageant. And it is a beautiful experience. But when I met him, he told me a lot about what goes on in politics. And if you think about the UK Parliament, which is the oldest democracy in the world, by the way, it's about 700 years old, the amount of influence that goes on before elections and during elections and after elections has been going on for hundreds of years. You know, we shouldn't be surprised. This has gone on a long, long time. And we see it today, we see it in the media. You know, our friends here, in terms of some of the journalism, there's a lot of influence that goes on. But I want to tell you, and the reason for kind of bringing up Dennis Skinner, because I want to tell you a funny story, because I think we're going to get, well, there'll be a lot of seriousness in our debate and our conversations here, but I thought this was really funny. So you imagine the UK Parliament, and you've got the two sides, so you have the Tories, which are like the Republicans, and the Labour, which are a little bit like the Liberals, going at each other. And Dennis stood up and he said, the problem, said he pointed to the other side of the house, to the Tories, the problem with this guy is, these people on this side of the house, is they're all thieves and liars. And the Speaker of the House said, Dennis, you cannot say that. That is not fair. You're not allowed to say things like that in the Houses of Parliament. So he said, the problem with these lot over there, half of them aren't thieves and liars. Which I thought was superb. It was a really clever way of kind of getting the point across. Anyway, but he taught me a lot. And he told me how, you know, this kind of manipulation goes on. And, you know, I've been a data guy for a long time. And I love the openness of the internet. And I think it's changed our lives in many, many ways. And with the advent of social media, I don't know about you, but I was really excited about it. I thought, this is going to be fantastic. We're now going to find out the truth. We're going to be able to share information. We're going to be able to get to the real cause of what's going on. We're going to understand what people feel and what people think. Oh, my God, has that backfired? And this is the issue. We share way too much about ourselves. But more importantly, we believe way too much about what we see on the internet. And I think that's part of the issue. We are so open to messaging, we're so open to ideas, that I think we've believed way, way too much. And that's a little bit about, are we really surprised that this has gone on? I mean, are we really, truly surprised that this manipulation and this meddling has actually gone on? The amount of, you know, like you were talking before about, you know, stuff within the election, within the state elections that's gone on from within, from our own parties, but the Russians coming in and meddling, I'm not surprised at all. And I think the real issue that we've got to think about here is, yes, it's happened, but why has it happened? Why has Russia meddled in Brexit? Because they have meddled in Brexit. And why have they meddled in these elections? And I started digging into this the other day, and it's actually quite hard to find the reasons why. There's so much press, there's so much dialogue about what's happened and how we're up in arms and it's wrong and it's an attack on our democracy, which is true, and we should be careful about it. But why have they done it? And do you know why? It's retaliation. We've been meddling in their elections for a long time. We've been meddling in elections all over the world. And I say we, the UK and the US, has been doing this. Mm-hmm. And they have retaliated. And it's been a lot about what happened when the wall got knocked down, what happened when Clinton supported Yeltsin in the elections, how that was manipulated, stuff that's gone on with the Ukrainian elections. They are retaliating. I'm not saying it's right, but we've got to figure out why this has occurred before we can figure out how we can manage it and cope with it. And I think if you look as well with the kind of the way that quote-unquote democracy works in Russia, Putin has seen this as a way of showing all the potential dissenters, look how strong I am. I can change the way elections have gone. And I think, you know, Robert, you're absolutely right. Did they really want Trump in power? I'm not sure they did. They just wanted to expose Clinton. They wanted to show that they had this influence. So I think that's an interesting part. So I'm fascinated to kind of see what happens on our debate and how we talk about this, because I think it's really important to kind of figure that out and what happens next. So what do we do? How do we move on from here? What are we actually going to do? And I think there's a lot of ideas, and we've seen Zuckerberg in front of the Senate committees. There's lots of stuff that we've seen in the press. And I think there's a balance here between free speech and what is controlled. Are we going to entrust people like Facebook to moderate what we see? How are they going to do that? Are we to say, well, we cannot be anonymous anymore when we want to post our views and our opinions, which goes against free speech? Or should we offer up our identity and our sources to ensure that it's validated and it's correct? And I think this is an enormous problem. It's something we've got to debate. It's something that we've got to discuss. And we've got to find out some solutions why.
Good
Thank
stuff.
You.
Thank you, Roger. Well, we already have a wealth of questions that you have submitted on cards and also on your apps. We're using both of those systems to take your questions. I'm supposed to read this now. To ask a question in the app, simply select this session in the schedule, tap Q&A, and then insert and send your question. You may also raise your hand to request a note card from our producers. Make your questions brief and to the point, and students, if they identify themselves, get preference in having their questions asked. I had a question that I wanted to address to the panelists, and it's a reflection in part of some of the questions already submitted, and that is about the doubt that we have in our government, our political system, that makes us so vulnerable to believing fake news. And we're trained by our capitalist system to be skeptical about mm-hmm. commercial advertising. I mean, who really believes the claims that advertising gives us about products? We're inundated with them, and we blow them off, basically. At least we think we do. What are the sources of the lack of faith in our political system that makes us believe the chatter on the internet and believe fake news? Does it come from the performance of our political system? Is it that Republicans and Democrats disappoint us so much when they're in power? The answer to this question, I think, is important because it does give us an indication of how we're going to reduce the amount of doubt that we Americans have in our system and make us less vulnerable to this manipulation.
Let me take a shot. None of this happens in a vacuum. First off, why would you have skepticism about the American process, how we make decisions, how we do things? I don't know. Vietnam, Iraq. You want to run down the list?
Watergate.
Watergate? Yeah, I mean, it's a very interesting thing about us. Partially, it is our relative transparency and our willingness to expose and debate and discuss things that has revealed to us that our government often lies to us and has lied to us in the most critical of moments when we're deciding whether to commit our sons and daughters to wars that might kill them. And we are today, we don't know if we'll go to sleep tonight in some sort of open conflict with Syria, with the Syrian government, and perhaps by extension the Russians. So this is pretty serious stuff. And if we can't have faith, if we can't believe in it, our skepticism does lead us to look elsewhere. So that's number one. We've been lied to. Number two, our media system has experienced the equivalent of a nuclear attack or an industrial revolution. Whatever, imagine something that totally destabilizes. The media system that we had in the United States 30 years ago no longer exists. The newspapers that once, you know, when you hit a newspaper landed on your front steps, it could crack the pavement, right? It was that thick. It was full of stuff. TV news was a much more serious thing, both the local and national level. Radio had all sorts of diversity within it. That has all been obliterated. Newspapers are now, by and large, shreds of their former selves, if they exist. Television is now all weather all the time. And on local, and national television, frankly, is a dumb beast that responds to whoever might give it the best ratings or clicks. And so as a result, you get an hour and a half of Donald Trump giving a speech without interruption. So we have a media system that is in chaos. Within it, we have brilliant reporters doing fantastic work in exposés, but it's not like Watergate. It's not like if somebody exposes something, the whole of the media system kind of begins to take it up and explore and get there. This atomization of our media system has created an opening for manipulation that is actually larger. We've always had manipulation. We've always had lies. We've always had games. We have a greater vulnerability today than we have had at any time in modern history because we have an atomization of the existing system. We don't have anywhere near as many reporters as we used to do. We have a much more open flow of information, but without anybody trying to figure out what's true and what is not. And so the way to understand this is we're in a transition moment. This moment will pass. This is the critical thing. We have to figure out what to ask for coming out of this. And my argument is that what we should ask for is a renewal of fact-based, journalist-driven news media in this country. Now, it's hard to get. No, but it's easier to say that than but the renewal of it is going to have to come through collective action. The market, I promise you, the market will not solve this problem because the advertising, which sustained a market-driven journalism, has fled into our phones and into our computers. And so the future is going to be some sort of collective answer on how we organize a media system that functions. And we are nowhere near that right now.
And just to add on to that, John and I have been on enough panels together this week that we are like this
kind of we can finish each other's sentences.
Meeting of the minds here, exactly. But the collapse of the media ecosystem isn't just that there are fewer media outlets. In a sense, in certain ways, there are actually more media outlets. Not all of them are trustworthy, but there is more. But it's not just that there are fewer. Fewer good, hardworking journalists out there, which is true. It's also the case that as the media entities have shrunk, there are fewer editors, there are fewer fact checkers. That means journalists are human and they make mistakes. Reporters will make mistakes. Good editors will catch those mistakes, or if they'll find some kind of inconsistency, they'll push back at the reporter and say, that story isn't quite where it's supposed to be yet. Go back and find a third source or a fourth source. You know, make sure that we really do have the story there. Now, when you don't necessarily have those kind of strong editors, you don't necessarily have those kind of fact checkers, mistakes get into stories. Or critical facts left out, critical context is left out, which then often leads if a glaring mistake is in there, that starts causing readers and viewers to distrust the media entity that produced that, which again creates more doubt in the entire system.
So what you just said, John, is very fascinating. But I am also looking at the challenge from Turkey.
Yeah.
And not only just Turkey, but places like Hungary and Poland as well. Hungary and Poland being members of the European Union and run countries where liberal democratic norms and values are supposed to be upheld. Now, in Turkey right now, you cannot have a critical debate. Because there is only basically one source of information, the pro-government media, and what is critical to democratic debate is questioning the information you're given. You still have the luxury to do that. But then, as you pointed out, as the moderator formulated the question, you are increasingly attributing credibility to sources of information, some of which are coming from Russia, that are doubtful. Yep. So in some ways, democratic space is besieged by two sides. And how to come out from there?
So how do we get better journalism if we're not willing to pay for it? Because isn't that the root cause?
Totally
nobody wants to pay for their news. Everything's free on Facebook. And the media is driven by clicks and ads and sensationalism sells. You know, Don Henley talked about this in Dirty Laundry.
He sure did.
Such a good song in terms of the lyrics that he put in that. How do we change that? How do we get people to say, well, I want to pay for this?
Well, one of the things we have to recognize is that they won't pay for it. And this, I'm a journalist. I've made, you know, made my living at this against forever. We've been, you guys are going to have to pay for it. You want to know what the reality is? We've tested it. We've had the experiment. Mm-hmm. It's failed. Mm-hmm. Okay? So what we have to understand now is that people do want information. But one of the challenges now is that with a void that has been created, the information about politics in this country comes increasingly from paid political ads and from what many people call fake news, but I wouldn't necessarily call it that. I would say just manufactured storylines.
Manipulated.
Yeah. And so what we have to do as a country is figure out how do we begin to empower the great mass of people to get the media that they need, right? And one thing that stuns me about the United States of America is the one place where we don't want to compete with and beat the rest of the world is having strong public broadcasting. Mm-hmm. Now, other countries, it's 30, 40, 50 to 1 ratio of what they put into public broadcasting. And you say, well, that's the government speaking. Actually, the more resources public broadcasting has in many countries around the world, the more independent and free it is if it's structurally well done. Germany, they have competing public broadcast networks from different regions. And so there are many ways to do this and to insulate it. We have never tried. We have never tried. Secondly, in other countries around the world, there is an understanding that you have to have competing media, right? And so you develop models that allow through tax policy and actually, let me give you an example. If I allowed everyone to deduct 3 or 4 subscriptions from your taxes, you know, I know some of you would read horrible things, right? I can look at you. I can see it in your eyes. But I know most of you, a lot of you would want to get some good local information, maybe some good regional, some good national. And I think there you have a citizen-driven way. If we could just let you take it off your taxes, it doesn't cost you a thing to support media that really does sustain. That pays for a lot of media. It's immense amounts of money that could be put in. And here's the interesting thing. You say, well, Mr. Nichols, that has never happened in the world. It's a crazy idea. It's an impossible notion, except for one thing. When the United States was founded, we used massive postal subsidies that were non-ideological to make sure that our initial media developed. Tom Paine wrote for subsidized media. And here's the other thing. Do you know who gets to deduct their subscriptions now? Billionaires. Because if you had a corporation, if you're very, very rich, you get to deduct all your subscriptions, all your media that comes from all sorts of information sources because it's a business expense. Why in heaven's name don't we allow citizens to have a citizen expense and deduct their efforts to get quality information?
And to follow up on that, we had a as I said, John and I had this discussion on a panel the other day. He was correct. In the early days of media, we had these great tax subsidies. We also had incredibly ideological and partisan media. I think one of the failures, actually, of media has been the lie that we have told ourselves over the last hundreds of years or so that media is supposed to be, quote, objective, unquote. The earliest newspapers were Alexander Hamilton created one of the earliest newspapers. Benjamin Franklin bankrolled earliest newspapers. And these were entities that largely were pushing the viewpoint of the large parties at the time, whether it was a Federalist perspective, what was then known as the Democrat-Republican Party perspective. And there were a lot more of them. You go into the early parts of the 19th century, the unions had their own newspapers, and there was an official Democrat, and on and on and on. The point there was that the Republic somehow came into being and kind of thrived, even though people found themselves buying newspapers that had competing ideological viewpoints. Striving for just plain objectivity causes, and John's, I know, has written about this, as have many people, the problem of both sides both sidesism, mm-hmm. where you know, well, you know, that politician killed his wife. Well, did he really kill his wife? Yeah, let's see what this commentator over here says. I mean, that's kind of absurd. We need to have, if we do want to have a return to quality, you know, quality journalism, we have to look at what we started with, and maybe we need to go back to the future.
Here's a question from the submitted by the app. Zuckerberg is under fire for Cambridge Analytics, and that is bad, yet the same data mining operations in the 2008 and 2012 Obama campaigns were framed in a very positive light. They were genius. Can you comment on how this interference differs?
Sure. I can take a quick hit. We wrote a couple chapters on this in our book, on our brilliantly titled book, Dollarocracy. And the interesting thing about what Obama did was many people misinterpreted what he was doing. People thought, wow, the Obama campaign, it's doing all this data analytics. It was to fundraise. What the Obama campaign was all about was fundraising. What we're talking about now is actually trying to influence voters.
Oh, with all due respect, I think there is a qualitative difference, I think, between what Obama was doing and what was going on in 2016. But it was fundraising, but there was a significant get out the vote aspect of that as well. I mean, and you can't completely separate those.
No, I don't at all. I think the fundraising was pretty ugly. I think what was happening in the fundraising was they were figuring out how to manipulate people, small donors, to give massively more than they would usually. So the fact of the matter is the Obama campaign went down a certain track and really did innovate. In fact, many people from the Obama campaign were so good at it they got hired out to go into tech companies. Then you've seen a new development on this thing. And we can go down this rabbit hole pretty far. What you're going to find is that there's an arms race on the part of both sides to get as good as they possibly can at managing, manipulating data. And for those who want to say, oh, well, the other guys did it, I absolutely cede that point. Without a doubt, the other guys did it. And you know what? Next time out, they're going to do it times double. And you're going to see more and more of it. So the question we have to ask ourselves is this what we want? Is this the politics we want, where our data is managed and manipulated by politicians to influence and scare us, right? Now, we're so far into this now that it's very hard to turn off. But what you really want to worry about a lot is folks who aren't your politicians coming in and manipulating it for reasons of interest that aren't even in that competition between two parties. And I won't go into it in deep level here because we don't have a lot of time. But one of the things I would recommend to everyone in the room is that, and I never, ever recommend that anyone read anything I haven't written. This is the first time I've ever done it. However.
That is mighty nice of you.
Yeah, except for Robert's stuff, which is brilliant. But this is a big deal. In December, December 11th edition of The New Yorker, just this last December, they did a piece called Estonia, the Digital Republic. It is an absolutely brilliant piece on how a country, Estonia, responded to an outside assault on its digital reality. Mm. And that response was to create top-to-bottom reform of how their digital media, how their digital commerce, all of this operates. And they really, really did a remarkable job of addressing the threat of manipulation of their communications and their politics. Now, do I say the Estonians got everything right? No, I don't. But what I am saying is they responded in 2007 to an assault on their, mm-hmm. basically their internet, mm-hmm. with a, they treated it the way we did 9/11. They said, this is something we have to look at from every direction and figure out how we make the most secure and functional system that is also sustaining of democracy and hopefully sustaining of pluralism. And I won't repeat the whole article. I'll just say, go read it. I promise you, if you read it, you will have a blueprint, not an answer, not what I say is all the right answers, but a blueprint for how seriously we should be thinking about these issues right now.
I would like to echo.
I
completely agree. I've been on a few panels this week talking about technology, talking about data, talking about AI, and the issue we have is that we don't understand, like we, the people, the public, but more importantly, the government does not understand how it works. They don't understand how it may go and where it might lead. But it particularly, when you look at what's been happening, like with Cambridge Analytica, big, you know, yes, they manipulated some data. They broke some terms of Facebook. But they've been doing this, and other companies have been doing this, and will continue to do this. We have to have a better understanding of the technology at a regulation perspective so that we can manage this properly. And I'm talking about all of our data and what we do with it and how we share it. We have to have better regulations, but we also have to have a better education to the public about what is it you're doing with your data? How do you check it? How do you validate it? How do you check on fake news? Do you know how to do this? I think probably most people in this room have probably got a good idea of how to check with fake news. And we're talking about not the people in this room, but the millions that perhaps just see a headline and believe it. Well, how do you educate them to look behind the headline and figure out where this has come from? I think it's a regulation and an education perspective that we have to put time into.
Now, a question submitted by a student. How do we keep our elections from getting attacked again when our president is so useless?
Robert.
Let me defend Donald Trump, and then I'll let Robert finish the. Or you go. You know, I want you to go first.
No.
I want you to go.
All right. No, you go ahead.
Let me defend Donald Trump. We had some problems before he came along. Donald Trump is a symptom of problems. He is not the crisis in and of himself. In fact, people who believe that Donald Trump is the sum total of everything that's wrong in the world, well, that's kind of how I felt this afternoon. But in reality, there are structural flaws and structural challenges that we have to understand. And what I believe Donald Trump was put on this earth to do one thing, and that is to reveal the vulnerabilities of the American political process. And boy, he has done it so well. He may have gone bankrupt in other things. He may have failed in so many things. But boy, has he shown us how vulnerable our system is. And I could run through all the many problems, but I'll talk about just one. In the United States of America, we have an electoral system, right, that creates a hole, right? We get to something with an executive and a Congress that is run by 50 states differently. And within the states, then differently at the county and even the local level sometimes, to the point where you design ballots differently from place to place. So in one Florida county in 2000, you're voting on a butterfly ballot, and another county you're voting on a caterpillar ballot, and you have as many as 3%, 4%, 5% of voters who are literally tossed out of the process because the ballots are badly designed. We don't have a there in America for how we hold elections. And it's a dream come true for manipulation. It's like, okay, well, I'm not gonna, it looks like Washington State does a pretty good job. I think I'm gonna go take, give me just a fish of thought here, and then I'll let you in. And say, but boy, Idaho looks like a real winner there. I think we can go in there. And so what I would argue is this. Let the states continue to run elections. It's how we've done it. It's constitutionally outlined. But let us give them some support for protecting this thing. There is a bill in the Congress of the United States that simply says this, that we in the United States, this is introduced by Mark Pocan and some other members, that we in the United States should treat our elections the same way we treat utilities. And utilities exist at the state level and are regulated at the state level, but there is an overall protection so that you don't have a foreign entity or even a domestic entity come in and do a cyber or digital attack where they turn all the lights out. We have an incredible level of good structural protection for our utilities so that they remain functional. If we simply did that with elections, we would have a tremendous level of additional security and also, I think, of additional confidence. And it astounds me that we spent all this time talking about Russia, legitimate part of our conversation, and we spent almost no time saying, okay, whether it happened or not, the fact that we're having the discussion should tell us that we need to change a whole bunch of things as regards security for elections, and we could do that, Democrats and Republicans, tomorrow, no matter how bad Donald Trump is.
Okay, it's opposite day. He wanted to defend the president, and I'm not going to do that. to the point, The given what happened in 2016, we had a president who still actually doesn't really want to admit that, well, yeah, it could have been the Russians, it could have been the Chinese, it could have been this kid, you know, like, what was it, the fat kid, that is a problem. Actually, the ridiculous, the $1.5 trillion spending bill that got passed last month, the ominous spending bill, as it's sometimes known as, actually does have some election stuff, and the only reason it got in there was it was ended up being this must pass monstrosity, and which the president like denounced even as he was getting ready to sign it. Russia attacked our electoral systems, the electoral environment, and there is some speculation that actual systems at the state level may have been penetrated as well. And instead, the president decides to create a voter fraud commission, which the only good thing about that was that it was so poorly run and incompetently run by Kris Kobach in Kansas that it kind of fell apart under its own weight. So the question that the student had is absolutely correct. I'm going to have to disagree with John. While it is true that there needs to that states do need more support in terms of security. I actually think that the fact that there are different systems at the state level is actually not a bad thing, because if you have uniformity at the state level, it is much easier to hack a uniform. If it's the same system in 50 states, it's much easier to hack that one system as opposed to trying to figure out 50 different ways to get into 50 different systems.
Next question, submitted on a card. What about the Russia tie to the Clinton Crime Foundation?
That's your question.
which?
I just read the card.
I think that it has to do with the argument that actually I don't even know what the Russia connection is. I do know that there's
a Russian, you know.
Well, no, there's legitimate questions about the connection between the Clinton Foundation and money it took from various donors, and there may have been, and the allegations that Hillary Clinton, while she was Secretary of State, engaged in certain favors that helped both the donors and the Clinton Foundation. Now, if that question is about uranium one stuff, that has actually been debunked a number of different times. That the deal with the company that supposedly got access to parts of U.S. uranium supply was signed off on by 7 or 8 different cabinet heads, of which the Department of State had only one vote. So this was not really a conspiracy of that the foundation took money and then Hillary helped push uranium to Russians. It's just not true.
Well, let's just put this one aside, though, and say that maybe he might be totally wrong. Maybe it's totally true. And I believe that if it's proven, President Clinton should be impeached and removed from office. And by the same token, anybody who was involved in something like this, and if we've got good evidence of it, they should be impeached and removed from office. The problem is, of course, that Clinton is only president on the Fox network, right? On the rest, every place else, Trump is the president. And so with all due respect, I think there's a certain argument for focusing on the person who's actually holding the office rather than the person who isn't.
It is actually kind of funny that she won the popular vote she won on Fox as well.
She is the president. She is the president of the Fox News Network. There's simply no question of that.
The next question was submitted by the app, but it's about three other questions that are pretty much the same one. Is Russia's meddling the United States just deserts for USA meddling in elections all over the world for decades?
Well, I mean, I think that's what I said in my opening statement. Whether I'd call it just desserts, I'm not sure, but I think that explains why. So I think, yeah, I mean, I would agree that that this is a classic case of retaliation and a demonstration of the power that Putin wants to show. You know, I think, as I said before, I'm not sure he had the intent of getting Mr. Trump in power. I think he wanted to discredit Clinton, and I think he more than anything wanted to show how he could, or they could, destabilize what is perceived as a very democratic process. So, you know, but I want to touch on some of the points from before. And I think it's one of the things we've got to do is have more transparency throughout the whole process. So throughout the process of disinformation, throughout the whole process of funding, where do you get your political funding from, how do you get it, and what influence that may have in your process. So surely it should be much more about transparency. If we can drive more transparency and show where this stuff comes from, show where the sources are from, push that onto the media sources, and I mean the regular media as well as Facebook and Twitter and everything else, force them to show where this comes from. They can very, very easily. Okay. Might cost them a bit more money. Well, hey, they're making billions anyway. Why can't they ensure that they are showing where this information comes from? And I think that will go a long way to help us weedle out. Because if you really dig into this stuff, I mean, I love looking at some of the news items, and I look at all sorts of stuff on my various feeds. And one of the things that I really like to do is you kind of read the article and then read the comments. Oh, my word, does that tell you what's going on? And you can spot the bots. You can spot what's going on. You can see how things are trying to be influenced, now they're trying to get the comments further up the pile. The technology is there to be able to show the transparency behind that. So why don't we enforce it and push it onto the providers to do this? And I mean news sources as well as the social media.
I would not want to put Russia and the United States in the same bag when it comes to democracy and elections. I would like to think that I'd be the last person that is blind to the problems that exist in the United States and to its foreign policy failings abroad. But I would argue that the reason why the Estonians were very quick in pulling up their socks is because they are Estonia and they are right there under the shadow of the bear. And had you been sitting in the back of that Impala in the 60s, you would know why I am saying making these remarks. Yes, there are problems with the U.S. There are problems with its democracy promotion. But let's go back to the Ukrainian experience. That explosion of the youth and the ordinary people. It's a difficult challenge there. Do you let and wait for the electoral system to resolve a conflict and the tension in the system, or do you respond to the street? And Putin is mad that on this particular occasion it looked like the politics was responding to the street. But if you're not allowing room for democracy to perform, to unfold, and let ordinary people to be able to reflect their opinion, be able to influence the unfolding of politics, what else can you expect? Look at what happened in my country, in Turkey. In May, June 2013, young people, professional people, very good at the digital world, etc., had, as the French would say, ras-le-bol. They had it enough from this creeping authoritarianism. And for once, they lifted their voice, they stuck their heads up, and look at the consequences. And part and parcel of repressing the public there was to blame the United States and blame specifically Obama. And if you read his Goldberg interview, you're going to see the remarks he makes about Erdogan. And through the closed doors, we did hear how he was so disappointed that he had hosted him for a private dinner at the White House, and only 2-3 weeks later, he was turning and blaming the United States and Obama for having provoked what happened in that square. So yes, there may be similarities, you know, it may be differences of degree, but to me, there is a degree between what Russia does and what the European Union and the U.S. does in terms of promoting fair and free democratic elections.
Generally speaking, the United States and the European Union don't go around poisoning their diplomats and foreign diplomats and so forth, generally speaking.
The next speaker, I think, has an agenda here that's not specifically mentioned. There seems to be an allegation that there is a serious hacker gap between Russia and the United States. The question is, Russia can vastly out-hack the U.S. because we will not recruit tech experts who use cannabis and are drawing from a much smaller pool. Does Russia care about what their hackers do in their free time, or do they put national security over personal habits?
That is a peak Boulder question I heard one.
Yeah. I'm going to go a step further and say that's actually so Boulder, it's out of a certain neighborhood. But here's, look. Do you want to know the interesting thing about the difference between Russia and the U.S. as regards...
Can I use this before you answer?
Thanks, brother. Between Russia and the U.S. as regards hackers? Our hackers go into the private sector, right? If you think that we don't have hackers who are hacking things like crazy, you're nuts. Of course they are. I go to tech conferences all over the world all the time and hear about hacking all over. In the West, hackers hack businesses. They hack each other, right? And they're trying to find out how to make money out of it. The Russians have indeed set up a system, and they certainly have their commerce and their oligarchs and stuff like that, but they've set up a system where there is some reward for being a hacker, and you know, there's some argument of that. But again, we think about all of this from a standpoint of, you know, what are they doing to us? What have we done to them in the past? Legitimate questions. I might not even, I love this guy, but I might not even be as gentle as you are. I think U.S. done some pretty rough things over the years. Yeah. I think there are, you know, and I understand all this. The killer of the current conversation is we have not gotten this discourse out of politics. We haven't gotten this, you know, because it's supposedly a national security thing. We haven't gotten it out of the Republicans did it, the Democrats did it, well, Clinton, well, Trump. Mm. And our desperate need as a country is to say, yeah, maybe there's a lot of history, there's a lot of division. We have the ability with evolving technology, as our friend has pointed out, to do a great deal to make our elections more secure, to make our systems more functional, and instead we are spending unimaginable amounts of time pointing fingers at one another and arguing about it when what we desperately need is people on both sides of the political divide in this country to step up and say, we think our ideas are the best. We think we can win. We just want to set up a system that is fair enough and functional enough that it will all work. And that is not a radical concept. Donald Trump is not capable of that. He is simply not capable of that. But the fact of the matter is that there are Republicans who are. And so one of the most important things that we want to look for right now is for a breaking point at which we can create some sort of alliance around electoral integrity and a redevelopment of a functional media system in this country. These ought to be central issues to our politics, and they're not. And I want one final element here, and then I'll be done. But first off, we have to have a functional relationship with Russia. That hasn't been said on this panel, and it should be. We are literally at a point where we're discussing the possibility of war actions in Syria that put us into conflict with Russia, and we need to have diplomatic relations with Russia, no matter how much we're angry at them, no matter how difficult the relationship is. And one of the best ways to make those relations work is to do much more to secure our election processes and make things absolutely stable here at home so that then we speak from a place of strength rather than one of fear of manipulation. Instead, we are so hyped up now that I fear the debate as regards Syria is getting warped by all these questions of whether does Trump like Russia, does Trump not like Russia, and so securing our elections and securing our election processes at home actually makes us much more capable of being a major player on the global stage, not for new wars, but actually for diplomacy and getting to some place where we might avoid those wars.
Can I add, indeed. I would say what John just said, but there is a plus element to it, an additional element to recognize that right now international relations and the world politics is going through a rough period. And in that rough period, you have to be able to deter the other side. I completely agree with strengthening the integrity of the electoral system and stop pointing fingers. But at the same time, you need to lift your head up and look beyond the horizon. And there is a war out there. It's not anymore as it used to be in the past, but it is taking the form of war through these digital system and what they call cyberspace. And you need to put some resources, some thinking into that beside what you say, John. Okay.
We're going to have to stop in just a moment. But I did want to let you know that there is a special event taking place. It actually began about 15 minutes ago or so. The Conference on World Affairs will be hosting a 70th celebration party on the Hill. There will be free food from Hill restaurants and live music. This event is open to everyone, so join us now till about 7 o'clock for this Hill Street event at the corner of 13th and Pennsylvania.
And I do just want to throw John talked about that New Yorker piece. It's the December 18th, not December 11th, the December 18th New Yorker on Estonia, if you want to read that.
So you have been a wonderful audience. Let's give our appreciation to a great panel.